Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 22nd Inside the Beltway by Drinker Biddle conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Risch. Please go ahead, sir.
Holly, thank you very much, and hello, everybody. As Holly said, this is our 22nd session. Since we do these quarterly, that means we've been doing it for 5.5 years. And for those who've been with you with us for much of that time, you know we've primarily focused on Department of Labor issues, litigation, fiduciary regulations, prohibited transaction exemptions, and things like that. But what we're finding now is that there is a convergence. There's more crossover with FINRA rules, with SEC rules, and all of the agencies and entities are involved together from this point forward. As a result, we're going to change a little bit and move a little bit away from just talking about the DOL aspect of this. We're going to talk about the SEC and FINRA aspects all together. And to do that today, we have two attorneys from our firm joining us. Jim Lundy, who was formerly with the SEC, and will give us an update on what's happening over there, particularly with regard to the Retire Initiative. And Sandy Granum, who is a FINRA attorney. In fact, she heads up our FINRA practice group, talking about possible claims related to the fiduciary rules and the changes that are going on that could be filed for FINRA arbitration. In addition to the two of them, of course, there's always me, Fred Risch, and I'm chair of the firm's ERISA Financial Services team, meaning that we represent people that sell products and services to plans, the people that help make plans tick. And Brad Campbell's with me. And Brad is, as you know, the former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration and brings a unique perspective of being able to look at it as a private practitioner who's represented clients that have to deal with these rules, but also as a regulator who helps develop and enforce the rules. So, and by the way, thanks to you all. We have almost 800 people signed up for this call, and we really appreciate your support. But in addition to your support, we also appreciate the support of Nat Tixis, who actually makes this happen. And before I get over to Jim Dolan and Nat Tixis, let me just say the program is being recorded. So if you want to listen to it again, you can. If you want to refer it to some of your compatriots, you can do that as well. It takes us a few days to get it up, so it won't be up for a couple of days, but it will be available, let's say early next week, under our website at drinkerbiddle.com. And there's a heading in there called Insights and Events. That's where it'll be. But you don't even really have to worry about that because we will email you with a link if you registered once it's up and set to be listened to. So it's all available to you. And as I said, Nat Tixis has done a great job of supporting us and allowing us to bring it to you. Our contact there, the guy we work with and have a lot of fun with putting these on together, is Jim Dolan, who's the Vice President for Retirement Strategies. And with that in mind, Jim, thank you very much. And is there anything you'd like to say to us?
Certainly. Thanks so much, Fred. I really appreciate it. And thanks for the partnership over the past 5 years. We're really grateful that Drinker Biddle is able to provide this type of perspective to the marketplace. I want to thank you. I want to thank everyone for calling in today. I want to thank Brad for his insight and for Jim and Sandy joining us. And as Fred mentioned, my name is Jim Dolan. I work at Natixis Global Asset Management. We're a multi-affiliate investment organization with expertise across fixed income, alternatives, and equities. But I'm really excited to share with you today one of our new strategies, which is created to allow plan participants to engage more effectively in their retirement plans. It's a sustainable future fund. This is an ESG target date strategy that allows investors to align their investments with their values. So I'd ask you to learn more about our firm at durableportfolios.com and our focus on retirement. And Fred, before I hand it back to you, you know, mentioned we've been on this call we've done this quarterly for 5 years. And I just want to thank Liz Jutila for all of her work behind the scenes to make this happen. So I know we have a lot of questions and a lot of topics to discuss today. So I'll hand it back to you.
Okay, Jim, thank you. And as Jim mentioned, Liz is the one that really makes this thing tick behind the scenes and never gets all the fun of being out in front, which I actually think she's glad she doesn't have to get out in front. But that aside, there is somebody, as you all know, there's somebody who makes these programs work and who coordinates everything and causes it to happen, and that's Liz. So we all thank Liz. Brad, you know, this is a quarterly call. I mean, it's been 3 months since the last call. Fair amounts happened over at the Department of Labor and elsewhere in the last 3 months. Why don't you start off today on the substantive issues by bringing us up to speed with from roughly 3, 4, 5 months ago up to today, what's happened? What's going on?
All right. Well, again, thanks, everybody, for taking the time to join us. So in terms of the fiduciary rule, as Fred says, we have had quite a bit happen in the past quarter. The Labor Department, as you all, of course, recall, reached sort of a compromise solution in which they implemented on June 9th the fiduciary provisions of the fiduciary rule, but deferred some of the most controversial provisions of the best interest contract exemption, of PTE 8424, and of the principal transaction exemption until January 1. And that period between June 9th to January 1 is the transition period, where we have the transition BIC exemption, which has basically the impartial conduct standards as its requirements, and the other transition versions of those exemptions. And DOL has done two major acts in between our last call and now. One is they put out a request for information where they asked the regulated community to provide information about whether this transition period should be extended, the pros and cons of doing so, and about the rule itself, and whether additional exemptions might make sense, what the effects of the rule have been in the real world since June 9th, and in running up to June 9th and preparing for it. And a tremendous amount of comments were received by the department, from, of course, across the spectrum of interested parties. Many folks in the financial services industry pointed out that it appears to them that the rule has been resulting in a reduced scope of investment options for IRA owners, to a certain extent for smaller plans, that it's increasing costs, that it's decreasing services. And there were, of course, counterarguments made by others in the consumer advocate community. The department's taken all of those comments into account that it received in this RFI, and one of the next steps it took was to propose extending the transition period, which right now is scheduled to end on January 1, just a few months away, and extending it into July of 2019. So in other words, having a total of about a two-year transition period, during which time the department would review the effects of the rule, as President Trump had ordered them to do in his February memorandum, look at the responses from the RFI, look at whether new exemptions or revised exemptions or other revised provisions of the rule make sense, and also use that time to coordinate with the SEC and state insurance regulators and others to ensure that the rule is functioning in a way that works to the benefit of the participants and IRA owners it's intended to help. So they proposed that here in July. The comment period is closed on the proposed extension. A couple of the issues there are whether the enforcement policy that DOL adopted, which said they would not pursue enforcement actions against folks who were trying in good faith and working diligently to comply, that currently is scheduled to end on January 1 as well. One of the questions they asked in the proposal was, should that be extended as well? Also issues about how should the proposal work? Should it be a flat calendar date? Certain, should it be hinged to other actions, such as the department promulgating a new final rule, et cetera. We don't know the answer to those yet, of course, because we're waiting for the department to issue the final rule regarding the delay. And while we don't know the details, I think it's pretty likely, and this, just to be clear, is where we're speculating, I think it's quite likely that they're going to end up with a final rule that looks a lot like the proposal. I think we will see a delay roughly to July of next year. I think that period is essential, really, for the department to be able to actually do the work necessary to review the rule and decide how to change it, but also to coordinate with the other agencies. One last thing, and this isn't a certainty yet. It's kind of a recent rumor, but you know, as we've discussed in past calls, one of the issues that's plagued the Labor Department on moving forward is that the Trump administration has been slow to fill some of the political leadership roles at the agencies. And there's a variety of reasons for this. Some of it has to do with Senate confirmation process. Some has to do with the administration not proposing new nominees, as well as hiring other politicals who don't go through Senate confirmation. But there's recently been a rumor that a Senate staffer named Preston Rutledge may be their choice for the head of EBSA. If that rumor is true, then that would be an important step forward in this process because it would be a nominee to run EBSA, which is, of course, the agency that's going to be reviewing all this information and making rule determinations. So if that rumor is true and we do see that nomination go forward, that would be an important step in seeing that the agency does have the personnel that it needs to go ahead and do the work required to get to a final rule. Of course, there's a lot of ground between nomination and confirmation going through the Senate process. But again, if that rumor is true, this person is currently the pension counsel for the Finance Committee. And typically, Senate staffers have easier times with confirmation than a lot of other nominees, given that they know all the other folks in the Senate and typically are working for their bosses rather than independently under their own names, putting out controversial ideas. So in a nutshell, Fred, I think that's where we are. We're waiting for the final rule on the extension of the transition period, which if I were to bet, I think will happen before the end of the month.
You know, Brad, just to add a little bit to what you said, and you know, with Brad pointing out that there hasn't been any assistant secretary nominated by the White House for the Employee Benefits Security Administration, which is known as EBSA, that means there hasn't been any leadership, that the Secretary of Labor, in addition to running the whole Labor Department and all the other things they had to deal with, was putting some of his time into this, but the Department of Labor is a huge place, and that there needed to be leadership in the regulation writing process, and there hasn't really been any, or very little. And in addition, there are another handful of appointed positions below the assistant secretary, and there's nobody there either. Nobody's been nominated for any of those positions either. So there has been a...
Well, more importantly, those don't actually require a nomination. They just haven't been filled.
Yeah, they just have to be appointed, but they aren't there. There was a complete vacuum of political leadership that can be traced back to the White House not naming people. But that means that if there is going to be leadership, and I think Preston Rutledge, who is the rumored person, is pretty well respected, that could enhance the process going forward. Brad, also, as you pointed out, the proposed rule is to extend the transition exemption to July 1, 2019, and that would give us about, not quite, but almost 2 years under the fiduciary regulation, but with the transition rules. And just so you all know, in my experience, a lot of people that refer to the fiduciary rule, when you start asking them what it is they're thinking about, it's not the fiduciary rule at all, because that's in effect. That's been in effect since June 9. It's the best interest contract exemption that they're referring to, but they mislabel it as the fiduciary rule, or they call the whole package the fiduciary rule. But we need to make a distinction between the fiduciary regulation that defines who is a fiduciary, and for ERISA plans, the standard of care, which is statutory, the duty of loyalty and the prudent man rule, and which cannot be changed for plans on the one hand, and the best interest contract exemption and the other exemptions, which impose, in many cases, a best interest standard of care on the advice to IRAs, for example. Okay, well, Brad, it seems to me that people are looking forward. Do you think, my experience so far is that folks heaved a huge sigh of relief when the transition rules came into play, but I'm worried that people heave too big a sigh of relief and that they don't realize there's still some significant compliance issues. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you said before is exactly right. There are a lot of people who are not being particularly precise in how they're describing what changes they want versus what's already in effect. And the reality is we actually need changes to all of the above. The fiduciary rule, by which I mean the actual definition of what's fiduciary advice and what isn't, has problems, holes, ambiguities, issues that have been identified in comments to the Obama administration that have never been addressed because, you know, what DOL put into effect on June 9th is word for word the fiduciary rule as the Obama administration wrote it. So there are some current compliance issues that people have to struggle through. It's, you know, it's not pure simplicity that the fiduciary rule has begun to apply. And there are also problems with the exemptions, particularly the ones that have been deferred during the transition period that need to be worked out. So, you know, I think if I divide it up into buckets, I've kind of looked at the fiduciary rule writ large as having three distinct aspects. One, current compliance. What issues do we have to understand and deal with since June 9th? Two, what's going to be the scope of this transition period? And I think the sigh of relief really came when DOL proposed making that transition period 2 years and giving us some real stability to work on these other questions. And then three is what comes next. And the what comes next is the part that we probably have the least ability to gauge yet because, as you pointed out, we haven't had the leadership at the Labor Department, the subject matter experts. Obviously, Secretary Acosta has been providing strong leadership. They've been moving the process through. But as you say, there hasn't been a dedicated, you know, staff whose sole job is to deal with this politically. Where they're going to end up on all of these questions, how should the fiduciary rule be modified, if at all? How should the exemptions be modified? Should there be new exemptions? Those questions, which were the subject of the RFI and deal with the final rule, those are the ones we really don't know the answers to yet because we're waiting to see who's going to make the policies. You're absolutely right. It's all of the above, and currently there are some real compliance issues that people are going through.
Yeah, Brad, my best guess is that the final best, and this is really, you know, taking a wild guess, but that the final best interest contract exemption, if it's still called that, will be something more similar to the transition rule than the final rule, but probably with a lot more disclosures than the transition rule. Do you think I'm completely off base, or do you sort of see it that way too?
Well, I don't think you're off base in the sense that I think that's what a lot of the comments on the RFI said, is that, you know, look, there are several problems with the full best interest contract exemption, the part that's been deferred. One of the key ones is the class action lawsuit provisions, which are, you know, a real significant concern of many commenters. Another is the fact that it basically requires either a level or a neutral fee for advisors, and both of those are difficult to achieve and expose a lot of litigation risk because of judgment calls that have to be made. And as, you know, any litigator will tell you, where there's a judgment call, there's a potential lawsuit because my expert will disagree with your expert about whether your judgment call was right. What you're describing would be the kind of approach that I think would go back to a reasonable fee rather than artificially level or neutral fee that would deal with the lawsuit issue. And I think what you're describing would be an outcome that a lot of people would find preferable to where we are. Again, it's not really clear yet because we just don't know who to ask at DOL as to whether that's where they'll end up or not. But I think it's a pretty safe bet the lawsuit provisions will be taken out by the Trump administration. Beyond that, I think that's where we need to, well, pay attention. And when the staff are there to go talk to them to make sure they understand, sort of treat this like it's 2015 all over again and go in and start at the beginning. Here's what this rule does right. Here's what it does wrong, in whatever your perspective is, and basically start over explaining to the new leadership of the department what you would like them to see change. And I think we just have to approach it that way. And again, acknowledging that there's a lot of coordination that needs to be done with other regulators like the SEC and the state insurance commissioners to make this work properly in the marketplace.
Okay. Well, Jim Lundy, you heard Brad say that the extension would allow time for the Department of Labor to meet and coordinate with the SEC and with the state insurance commissioners and the like. I know you've been working on some projects and looking into the SEC and its work on the fiduciary rule. Could you bring us up to date with what you're hearing about what the SEC is doing?
Sure. Thank you, Fred. Good day, everyone. I think you all know by way of background that Chairman Clayton issued a statement on June 1st, 2017, seeking comments. Since that time, numerous substantive comment letters have been submitted. Some examples are the Investment Advisor Association comment letter and also some comment letters by the large broker-dealers. And that has kind of brought us up to where we are today. And just last week, before the House Financial Services Committee, Chairman Clayton said that the SEC will be proposing a rule. However, he did not offer a timeline, and that's not surprising. Much like what's going on at DOL, there's issues with the current leadership at the SEC. Commissioner nominee Hester Pierce and Commissioner nominee Robert Jackson are currently awaiting confirmation. So we only have the chairman and two commissioners sitting right now. With the nature of the complexity and controversial aspects of this rule, Chairman Clayton will want a full commission to be in place to assess any proposed rule that develops. The other unique feature that will impact the timing is that this rule will very much involve a collaborative effort by two of the SEC's divisions, the Division of Investment Management and the Division of Trading and Markets. Historically, the SEC views fiduciary issues as an investment advisor issue and not so much a broker-dealer issue, and that's consistent with where their prior efforts in rulemaking occurred when they attempted to amend the Investment Advisors Act back in 2005 with a rule to address some of these issues that ultimately was struck down by the D.C. Circuit. The reason I mention that is most of the rulemaking from the policy divisions at the SEC come by one particular division. And in this area, there will definitely involve collaboration between the Division of Trading and Markets and the Division of Investment Management, who view the financial services world very differently in that one oversees the brokerage industry, one oversees the investment advisory industry, and they have different approaches. The Division of Investment Management and investment advisory industry is very much viewed from a principles-based approach, whereas the brokerage industry, the SEC coupled with FINRA, is very much on a rulemaking approach, detailed rules at that. So there's a lot of moving parts here, Fred, with the commissioners needing to be confirmed and some of the issues that I raised. The timing is going to be, you know, spring and summer, I think, before we see a proposed rule, and then the rulemaking process has to continue from there. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Fred, for any questions.
Okay. I mean, it looks to me like with Brad saying somewhere in the next month or so, we should get hear that the rules or the exemptions, the transition exemptions, are going to be extended out to June 30, 2019, and then Brad saying we need appointees at the DOL or we need people named to the positions for EBSA, and that's starting to happen. And as you pointed out, there are two commissioners at the SEC who've been nominated. I don't even know if the hearing process has started on them yet. I mean, as I add all that up, Jim, it almost sounds to me like, what you just said, it's going to be hard for much to get done other than what we've already said between now and the end of the year. It seems like a early 2018 thing. Do you more or less agree with that?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the timing, due to the uncertainty in the leadership in both agencies, is going to be, as Brad explained. And I think it's important, you know, in all of his public statements, starting with his June 1st statement through his testimony before the House Financial Services Committee last week, Chairman Clayton repeatedly emphasizes that there will be close coordination with the Department of Labor. So that aspect of it aligns with needing to get the additional commissioners at the SEC confirmed and the other positions filled at the DOL.
Yeah, and this is Brad. Just to back that up, I would say we're also hearing the same language from DOL, that they very much want to work with the SEC moving forward on this. So I think there's a level of cooperation desired by the leaders of these two agencies that's very different than where we were last year in the Obama administration.
Agreed completely.
I think I've heard three things just back and forth. One is that whatever the rule is, both agencies agree that it will allow both transaction-based compensation and advisory compensation, fee compensation, that there will be increased disclosures. At least that's what Final Bice says, and I've read reports that Chairman Clayton is saying that also, and that there will be a standard of care above and beyond disclosures. I believe that Chairman Clayton said that, and I know the DOL feels that way. So to put a little more meat on the bone, it seems to me that those are perhaps the overarching themes of their work together. And the people who think that it's somehow going to preclude commission-based compensation, no, it won't. And for people who think that somehow it's just going to be disclosure-based, no, it won't. That's my prognosis of what's going on right now. But of course, there's two old sayings, or there's an old saying that there's two things that children should never see. And one is how sausage is made, and the other is how legislation is made. And I think that can apply to regulations also. Well, Jim, back to you again. You know, if we go back a few years to 2015, I think it was 2015 when the SEC announced its retire initiative, which has been largely unheralded. I mean, it just hasn't received a lot of publicity that I've seen. But my understanding is that the SEC has been working on that and examining on that basis. Could you briefly describe to us what the retirement initiative is and let us know what's happened over the last couple of years as a part of that initiative?
Sure. Thank you, Fred. The retirement initiative was announced in an Office of Compliance Inspection and Examinations alert, which is the process that the SEC approximately 5 to 7 years ago started doing to periodically indicate to the financial industry where they would be devoting resources and emphasizing certain strategies that they had for regulating broker-dealers and investment advisors. And the Retire Initiative was focused in the retirement aspect of the retail brokerage industry. And while there has not been much said publicly about it, I was able to gather some information from sources, and it has been a significant effort. The SEC conducted over 250 examinations. While they will not be issuing a public report, it was reported to me that there is a detailed internal report in final draft stage that will go to the commissioners, and that this is something that is being developed over phases. And the description used for this first phase on the heels of the initiative was exactly that. It was called Phase 1, and it continued through their fiscal year 2016. And several of the issues that they came across were areas where they were focusing on the recommendations made to retirees, where there were questions raised about the possibility of placement in inappropriate mutual fund share classes, misleading marketing materials with respect to brokerage offerings and specifically including rollovers, lack of documentation to support the reasonableness of recommendations made, including recommendations regarding rollovers, vague or omitted disclosures to investors regarding fees, conflicts, and the services of affiliates, and misleading and touting of credentials of representatives, and lastly and generally the accompanying supervision and compliance breakdowns. While there has not been a public report issued, we've seen enforcement cases addressing these issues. While the pronouncements related to those cases have not specifically referenced the Retire Initiative, pursuant to my sources, that's where those cases developed from referrals due to the initiative. There's also been discussion in speeches by commissioners and SEC leadership. And I think ultimately this built up to an announcement that came out on September 25th of this past year. And in that announcement, the SEC disclosed that the Enforcement Division had developed a retail strategy task force that would be working closely with the OC examination staff. And while it did not specifically reference the Retire Initiative, when you read the release, what it discusses aligns with what is discussed in the Retire Initiative. And in between the announcement of the Retail Strategy Task Force and the Retire Initiative, there was a similar discussion in OC's examination priorities letter for 2017 that aligns with what's discussed in the Retail Strategy Task Force for where the SEC is going to be looking going forward and devoting its resources. And that, it was referred to me as Phase 2. And what they're looking at is the recommendations in sales of variable insurance products, the sales and management of target date funds, the controls surrounding cross transactions, and in particular with fixed income securities. So that's where I think things are headed, Fred, and I'm happy to turn it over to you for any questions.
Yeah, I have a couple questions, Jim. The first one is half comment, half question. You mentioned share classes. It seems to me that the SEC, FINRA, and the DOL are all examining and investigating and even litigating on share class issues. Is that consistent? I mean, did I accurately represent what the SEC is doing, and why are they doing it? What's their concern?
You are accurate in that regard, Fred, and I failed to mention, and you reminded me, that in speaking of risk alerts, the SEC's OC issued a risk alert regarding share class mutual funds and their concern in that space in 2016. So what we're seeing with the enforcement cases coming out of that, and the SEC and FINRA refer matters back and forth, and Sandy will probably talk about this as well, is you're seeing the evolution of that risk alert, the work done by the exam staff, and ultimately referrals of matters to enforcement. And that's where you see the cases that have been filed probably over the last 6 to 9 months. And the concern is always the disclosure aspect of the front-loaded share classes and retail investors being steered to those when perhaps there are other classes, Class B, Class C shares, institutional shares, that may have lower parameters that allow certain retail investors to access those institutional shares. And ultimately, it's a disclosure issue from the SEC perspective. If presented with all of those classes and the investor decides to do a front-end load mutual share class, that's the decision that they make. But the concern is that the disclosures are not adequate and that the brokerage firms are advocating their own interests, putting the retail investors into higher fee share classes to benefit their interests from a revenue perspective to the disadvantage of their retail customers.
Yeah, I'm working on a DOL investigation right now where the DOL is taking the position that for an RIA rather than a broker-dealer, that the recommendation of transfer fee funds versus no transfer fee funds, or transaction fee funds versus no transaction fee funds is a fiduciary consideration. And so, for example, if it were to be a longer-term holding, it would probably make more sense to recommend a transaction fee fund because the expense ratios tend to be lower, and vice versa if it was a short-term holding. And I think that, which is highly analogous in my mind to the share class issue, what's thought as being given and delivering the right price to the investor. Jim, one more question. You and I were talking about a case recently that I was involved in where an advisor recommended that a participant roll over and then invest their money in an interest-bearing account while the advisor and the investor figured out how to the advisor and the participant figured out how to invest the money. And the SEC said, hey, wait a second, how can you recommend a rollover without having done some of that analysis as a part of the rollover process? Could you tell me what you think the SEC's thinking was on that?
I can, and I think what the SEC's thinking is on that is the efforts need to be documented and documented reasonably, and they view a rollover as any other recommendation, and it's consistent with the FINRA guidance under FINRA's rules and regulatory notices. So they assess it as a recommendation, and whether it be from the advisory perspective and the fiduciary obligations of an advisor or the suitability obligations of a broker, they expect there to be an analysis and documentation of the analysis to support the recommendation. And if the documentation is lacking, they will view the lack of documentation in and of itself as potentially violative of the advisory or brokerage rules that apply to that transaction.
Okay. Well, Jim, let me go over to Sandy now. You mentioned Sandy and that she might have some thoughts on what you were saying. And Sandy, you know, as I told you all earlier, Sandy's the head of our FINRA practice, and her practice includes both arbitrations or controversy work and compliance work. So, Sandy, you and I have batted the ball back and forth some about what kinds of claims you're seeing now. Fiduciary-related claims, some of your concerns about possible claims are going forward. With that introduction, why don't I just turn it over to you to talk about that a little bit?
Thanks, Fred. So in the FINRA forum, the claim itself is confidential. So we don't actually see the way the claim is articulated. FINRA does keep statistics on the types of claims that are being brought, but it's not until you get to the award, when the award is public, that you have a sense of what the allegations, the full allegations might have been. So for instance, and I think that the FINRA form has sort of been gearing up for the advent of the fiduciary rule for some time now. It's always been the case in FINRA-type arbitrations that many allegations are sort of thrown against the wall to see what will stick. And for the last several years, since 2013, breach of fiduciary duty has been the number one player in the allegation forum. And even though that's the case, over the last several years, it's been increasing dramatically. So for instance, in 2013, there were a total of 3,714 cases brought in, and of those, 1,800 had a breach of fiduciary duty allegation. In 2016, the caseload lowered to 3,600, but the fiduciary claims rose to 2,002, so significant increase. This year, through August, there have been claims of breach of fiduciary duty up to 1,902, and that's even, that's just August. And the date of the rule, even the interim rule, wasn't until June 2017. So a lot of the claims were being brought in anticipation of the rule. And although we can't see what the allegations are, I have seen a few of the claims that have been brought. And they have been brought citing to the rule, interestingly enough, even before the rule was invoked in June, on June 9th. And the allegations conflated oftentimes retirement accounts with regular accounts. So there's been sort of a stream of consciousness just trying to pitch out to the arbitrators the possibility that there should be a fiduciary standard for everything, not just retirement accounts. As to the types of claims I think that will be brought, I think that we can look to the claims that have awards in the 401k space. And like the fiduciary duty claims, the 401k claim awards have been coming rather frequently. In 2016, for the total year of 2016, there were 27 cases brought regarding 401ks. In 2017 through August, there's already been 52. So once again, there's like a run-up on those cases. But the type of allegations and the awards that we're seeing in that space are, of course, breach of fiduciary duty, as they relate to things like fees and recommendations of securities. I suspect that added to that list will be the recommendation to roll over funds, since now that's sort of in the ballpark. And it will apply not just to 401ks, but to IRAs. Until there's a true best interest contract, the commonality aspect of these kinds of claims, I think, is suspect. So in the FINRA forum, class actions are not brought at the arbitration stage. You can always bring a class action in court. So Brad was talking about the possibility of a class action being removed by the present administration. I don't know that that will necessarily affect or reduce the possibility of class actions against broker-dealers, because the way the rule presently speaks, if you have a class action, you can always go to court. And notwithstanding the fact that courts have been vigorously upholding class action waivers, FINRA opposes class action waivers and will commence sanction proceedings, regulatory proceedings, if you try to put that into your contracts. And many of you might know there was Charles Schwab had a class action waiver, which should have been legally sufficient in the contract, but FINRA took exception to it and brought a regulatory proceeding, which ultimately ended up with a settlement, an AWC, on that form. So I think with regard to what types of cases we'll see suitability-type cases with regard to recommendations on what was appropriate for the particular fund or IRA. We will see fees. We will see rollover. And we might possibly see class actions for commonality-type things like, brokers and their 401ks, or as Jim mentioned, marketing material relating to rollovers or marketing material that relates to particular securities that are suggested for retirement accounts, but things that have, you know, global touches. Do you agree, Fred?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, based on some of our conversations about how FINRA arbitrations work, Sandy, you've pointed out to me that a lot of outside claims get included, and you know, I also think that in terms of state claims, I think that we're going to start seeing an expansion of the fiduciary rule in state law, not just like what Nevada is doing, which would be an actionable breach for violation of state law if there's a breach of fiduciary duty. But also, most state laws have poorly defined fiduciary rules, you know, going based on the old trust laws. And I think that we could begin to see more assertion of those rules as well, just because all of a sudden everybody knows how to spell fiduciary. I do agree very much so, Sandy.
I mean, generally, in the securities industry, the rule has always been you generally don't have a fiduciary duty, but there have been states that have had specific fiduciary statutes, and I think you're right. There will be probably more states going in that direction.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Fred, this is Brad. One thing we should probably point out is the fiduciary rule also had in the deferred BIC provisions some limitations on arbitration, which the Department of Labor and the federal government has backed off of, and in fact has indicated they won't enforce if they were to, you know, apply, because the transition period isn't extended. That has to do with limitations on the ability to impose restrictions on arbitration that was decided in some other cases. So the Labor Department and the Department of Justice indicated they wouldn't pursue those in the context of the fiduciary rule. So that may be an issue that's playing out as well under some of the security statutes, depending on how the implications of this, you know, other arbitration-related court decision filters across some of these other statutes.
Yeah, I think that would take a change of position by FINRA, which right now says to their regulated entities, you can't prohibit class action litigation. But you know, it's going to be interesting where all this ultimately falls out, because I'm a great believer in the law of unintended consequences, and you know, it seems to me that while we can try to take today's developments and extend them into the future logically, it doesn't always work out that way. So in my mind, the lesson for the audience is, you really ought to be safe, just to be cautious. You ought to anticipate more fiduciary claims. As Sandy said, rollovers is a great area. Transfers of IRAs can be another area. But just a plain prudent process or a best interest process could be another area. And what I would do if I were an advisor of any kind, I would examine my approach. Do I have a documented step-by-step prudent approach for developing investment recommendations? And I would go through that and re-examine it, because we live in a different world today than we did just a few years ago. And if you set up your processes a few years ago, then, you know, it's possible that some changes. So now is a good time to go back and re-examine what you're doing, re-examine the advice to IRAs. What is your process for advice to IRAs? How are you documenting it? I know for broker-dealers in particular, there's a concern that they may not be documenting the development of advice as they develop the advice, but maybe it's being developed after, it's being documented after the fact, which, you know, sometimes doesn't happen. Sometimes it's insufficient. How do you use systems to concurrently develop and document the prudence of the advice? So at some level, I think that's the moral of the story that we're all telling you. And to extend that to some areas they may not have traditionally thought about, like advice to IRAs, advice on rollovers, advice on IRA transfers. Hey, Sandy, let me come back to you with a question that somebody asked before the call. We have a whole series of questions before the call, and we're gonna try to get through the pre-submitted questions before we open it up. And I will synthesize the question. Put on your compliance hat, Sandy. The one questioner said, "Gee." They're a record keeper, and they're getting inquiries from broker-dealers where the broker-dealers are saying they want to be compensated based on a level fee based on the total assets in the plan. For example, 25 basis points, as opposed to 12b1 fees or insurance commissions. And the record keeper says, is there any way that a broker-dealer can get that without having to register as an RIA and have the advisor be an IAR? What do you think?
I think that, first of all, most broker-dealers do have an RIA component, and the broker-dealers that I've been dealing with, when they're brokers are dealing with level fee type of relationships, so relationships that would otherwise be governed under the 40s Act. So they were fiduciary to begin with, either because they were discretionary or they were applying a level fee. They had state equivalents or IRAs, so they were considered, they were treated kind of like investment advisors. I think the record keepers might be right, but to the extent that they're asking for level fees, they're going to put themselves in the place of the investment advisor and probably should have the right licensing.
Yeah, I've seen a few cases where record keepers have had arrangements with the broker-dealers, because many of the services provided to 401k plans are not investment. You're being paid for other than an investment recommendation. Or certainly, I would think that part could be, you wouldn't have to be an RIA. But what the issue comes up, I think, Sandy, where, some broker-dealers may only have half of their advisors that are IARs, and the other half aren't. And so they're struggling with how do they get compensated for the half that aren't. Is there any way you think to structure a commission for the kinds of services that a broker-dealer could offer that covers the assets as a whole, or do you think that it's difficult?
I think it's difficult because of the way we define commissions as transaction by transaction. Other compensation, and I don't know, Fred, if it's possible that the brokerage firm itself could have a level fee, but then the broker gets some kind of commission. But that, I don't know, would abide by the DOL rule.
Yeah, I mean, I think fortunately under the DOL rule, the best interest contract exemption where you don't have discretion, it only applies where you don't have discretion. The best interest contract exemption permits some variability of compensation, so that there could be unlevel compensation so long as the aggregate compensation was reasonable. So I think under that there is a workaround. And certainly for group annuity contracts, you levelize compensation. You do receive compensation as an insurance commission on total assets. So it's more of an architecture platform issue, but it sounds like it could be a problem. Let me move on to the next question. Brad, there were several questions that we got about the legislation, the tax proposal. And I don't think there's any kind of a bill yet, but there is a very broad proposal. One question is, do we think that Congress can actually start working together to do anything? Other questions are more specific, like do you think we'll get anything done in 2017? What do you think the issues are going to be for retirement plans and so on? So can I just aggregate those questions together and you answer it as one big question? Brad?
Sorry, I had myself muted, didn't I? Congress is working right now to try to do comprehensive tax reform. They're going through a budgeting process, which would use what they call the reconciliation process. The goal of that is to be able to get a tax bill that can go through the Senate with only 50 votes instead of needing 60 votes. And so part of that is, deals with whether the bill is revenue neutral. Part of it deals with the instructions that are given on where to find revenue to achieve neutrality. In other words, to change all the rules and do all the big things you're reading about that they're talking about doing. You know, reducing the corporate income tax rate, shrinking the bans on individual tax rates, expanding deduction issues, et cetera. Can they do all that and end up in financially much the same place? So to do that, they need to raise revenue. It's important to note that neither President Trump's proposal nor what we've seen so far from Republicans on the Hill specifically identifies retirement plans as a source of tax changes that would raise revenue. But it's, I think, very unlikely they can actually get to the finish line without tapping some of that revenue. And the one of the primary ways we're hearing that they're at least thinking about doing this is through use of mandatory Roth features in plans and IRAs. Now, exactly what form it might take, we don't really know yet. There was a proposal a couple of years ago by former Ways and Means Chairman Camp to have the first half of your elective contributions to a 401k, for example, be pre-tax and the second half be mandatory Roth. He had also proposed freezing the increases for inflation in the limits under 402G, et cetera. I think all of that is on the table in one form or another, even though they haven't officially written it down. Just the you know, amount of money they need to raise to do what they want to do and the sources of funding, number one being health benefits, number two being mortgage interest deduction, and number three being retirement tax incentives, they are going to pretty much, I think, have to dip into something. So I think it's quite likely that as we go through tax reform, we're going to see changes to the tax treatment of plans. And how sort of damaging those are, I think, depends on what they ultimately do. Could they change the, you know, start means testing exclusions from income, et cetera? There's a lot of different ways they could address the tax problem, some of which would affect the incentives to not only participate in plans, but for small businesses, for example, to offer 401ks as opposed to other types of opportunities. You know, if the owner of a small business and his or her family can't participate to the full extent in a 401k, for example, are they going to be as interested in going through the effort required to offer one? So there's a lot to be done here. I think Congress has a decent chance at getting tax reform done. It's by no means an easy climb, but I think they do have a chance of doing it. I think it's a credible effort being mounted, and we really need to keep our eyes on that process as it goes forward. And we should get some guidance here in the next week or two as we see the budget reconciliation process and all the resolutions and things that have to go through for that, see those come through and get some guidance on it. That said, it's not an easy thing. It's going to be a significant effort, but it's one that they could actually achieve and could affect all of us in the long term on retirement plans.
Moving along, another question for Sandy. Sandy, it says, what should a broker-dealer RIA do with regard to the appropriate person for overseeing compliance with the impartial conduct standards? Should the firm's E&O policy have specific provisions regarding these duties? What do you think about that?
I'm sorry, Fred. Say the question again.
Should a broker-dealer RIA, what should a broker-dealer RIA do with regard to the appropriate person for overseeing compliance? I assume there's a chief compliance officer or somebody in charge of overseeing compliance with impartial conduct standards. What should they do? Should they have a specific person? What kind of things do they need to do about that? And should they get specific provisions in their E&O policy?
So FINRA requires that you appoint a specific person to be responsible for all supervisory issues and that you have sufficient written supervisory procedures to accommodate any new rules. So I think that whether or not any other regulatory authority would find exception with not having an appointed person, FINRA would. So under their WSPs, you would expect to have a rule in place and someone who's designated as the right person to administer that rule. As for the E&O policy, I don't believe that it would hurt to have appropriate E&O policy to protect against any liability or malfeasance on the part of that individual, but I do believe that you will need to have a designated person to satisfy FINRA. So I turn it back to you, Fred.
Yeah, I know Sandy and I and Bruce Ashton here have worked on developing policies and procedures that are appropriate for broker-dealers for the best interest standard of care and the impartial conduct standards. I worry that a lot of people haven't actually put those in yet, but those are all the transition rules apply now, the impartial conduct standards apply now, the fiduciary rule applies now. I worry that broker-dealers may not have policies and procedures and training and supervision in place for compliance. So that's certainly something in the back of my mind.
In addition, Fred, even the transition period for the rule, it says there will be no enforcement provided you have made a good faith effort to abide by the rule. And I don't know how you could possibly do that without having something written or something that shows that you did a review of your policies and procedures to say, yes, I've made a good faith effort to abide by the rule.
Okay, good. Let me answer the next question. It says, what are some of the latest lawsuits that are occurring in the 401k industry? How can a plan sponsor and financial advisors protect themselves from frivolous lawsuits? Actually, it's harder to protect yourself from the merited lawsuits than it is the frivolous lawsuits. But aside from being cute with words, let me answer the question. Right now, the claims tend to primarily be that the plan is invested in the wrong share class, an overly expensive share class, that a plan is invested in excessively expensive mutual funds generally, not just share class, but generally, that the plan is paying too much for the record-keeping services, taking into account the revenue sharing that the record keeper is receiving plus any direct fees, and that the plan is paying too much for the advisor services, the broker-dealer services, or the RIA services. Interestingly, if you noticed, I did not mention once that there are a lot of claims about crappy investments. There aren't. Everybody worries about that, but that's not where the action is. The action is in things that can be quantified. So if you want to avoid frivolous lawsuits or any lawsuits, because remember, contingent fee plaintiff's attorneys are business people. They're not going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars of their time on a case that's going to be extraordinarily difficult to win. It's just not who they are. They want to think they've got a good chance of winning the case before they invest that kind of time for free. So on the share class issue, have at least one committee meeting a year on whether or not you have the right share class, and go through the share classes and explain them to the committee, to the plan sponsor, and talk about why you have that share class and why it's not a different share class. Second thing, the overall cost of shares, the expense of share of mutual funds, rather. Benchmark them relative to a plan that size, not just some wide industry benchmark, but a benchmark, a $10 million plan, a $100 million plan, a $1 billion plan. They're very different in terms of expense. The same thing for record keeping. Benchmark it or go out on an RFP or an RFI, but do something. The rule of thumb in the industry, but not the law, is every 3 years. So at the least, I would do it every 3 years. Some people do it every year. Some people do it every 2 years in terms of a formal benchmarking process. But what the law says is you have to do it at appropriate intervals, but then it doesn't define appropriate. So that's why 1 year, every year, every 2 years, every 3 years has sort of become, those are the different practices of people in the industry. And then finally, we're starting to see some claims against advisors being overcompensated. Same thing, benchmark it. What are your services being provided to the plan and for a plan of that size compared to what most people provide? And what are your fees relative to that? I will tell you, for example, most advisors provide a robust set of services to plans. That benchmarks one way. Some advisors also provide a robust set of services to participants, including one-on-one meetings. They're entitled to more money because they're providing more services. So your benchmarking can't just be, hey, what's the norm? Your benchmarking has to be, what services do you provide and what's a fair fee for that? So anyway, that's the hot area. Those are the areas that you want to guard against, and make sure you document it in the committee minutes, benchmarking reports in the files, on and on. Brad, you know, you and I, and most people, tend to refer to plans and IRAs. somebody asked what other kinds of accounts are involved. Could you just mention a few of those so we open it up to the fact that it's not just plans and IRAs?
Yeah, so the fiduciary rule technically applies to any ERISA plan that's subject to Part 4 of Title 1 of ERISA, in other words, an ERISA plan. But, of course, there has to be an investable component about which you're giving investment advice. So while it could apply, for example, to a welfare arrangement, the welfare arrangement would have to have some sort of investment advice provision in it to make the rule applicable to it. The other trigger for coverage is that the entity is subject to Section 4975 of the code. These are the privated transaction rules in the code. And so while we say plans and IRAs, and typically we're talking about various types of pension plans and IRA accounts, it does include a few other things. For example, covered LESAs, to the extent anyone has those still, are going to be covered by it. But probably the biggest other area is HSAs. So if you've structured your HSA as a plan sponsor properly, so to speak, the HSA itself is probably not a plan. However, the prohibited transaction rules apply to the HSA account. And if you then tell a participant in that HSA how they should invest their HSA assets, that would be fiduciary advice covered by the rule. So you can get a very odd result that the plan's HSA program is not, or excuse me, the employer's HSA program is not a plan, but it is fiduciary advice to tell an individual participating in that plan how to allocate their investments, and the rule would apply to that. Those are probably the biggest distinctions, but HSAs, I think, are probably the biggest component we don't commonly talk about. But individual advice to an HSA is subject to the rule.
Yeah, and just to add one more thing to that, when you recommend a rollover from a plan, a distribution rollover, a lot of people seem to think that's not subject to ERISA. It may be subject to these rules, but not ERISA. It is considered a recommendation to a plan, and therefore all of ERISA's remedial provisions apply. So there is a litigation and arbitration scheme in place for that, even though it's not entirely clear how some of these rules will be enforced with IRAs. That's not an IRA. That's a recommendation to a plan. Jim or Sandy, let me ask you one last question, and then we'll be done with it. Somebody said, how can there be a harmonized fiduciary standard of care where registered representatives and insurance agents are operating under a principal agency rule, where typically the agent has a duty of loyalty to the principal, but now these rules are going to say they have a duty of loyalty to the investor? Isn't there a conflict there, and how can that get resolved? Either one of you guys can jump in.
Well, I do believe there's a conflict. I don't know that there's that much more of a conflict than there would be, say, for instance, a broker recommending a stock to an investor that his firm makes a market in. And still, there are situations where even today, that recommendation would have to be a fiduciary recommendation, for instance, under the 40 Act, if it were an advisory account, or if it were an account where they had discretion. Now, I understand that proprietary trading in retirement accounts will be limited at best, but I do think that there are circumstances now where a broker has a divided interest between the firm and his client, and I don't know that that's that much dissimilar.
I agree. Well, I agree with Sandy, and I don't know if this is the answer, because I think it's more complex than just saying disclosure. That is, from the SEC perspective, the fallback remedy to inherent conflicts that occur when the rep has its own relationships with its employer and affiliates, and also obviously has its suitability obligations as a brokerage firm or its fiduciary obligations as an advisory firm to the client. I think it is more complex than that, Fred, other than simply saying disclose it, but I think that would be the SEC's perspective, to try to get as much detail out there as possible so that the conflict is disclosed.
Thank you. Thank both of you. Well, everybody, and we've run out of time, but we promised to answer all the pre-submitted questions, and we have. So let me turn it over to Jim Dolan to wrap up the program for today and to give you a couple pieces of important information. Jim?
Thanks so much, Fred. Appreciate it. On behalf of Natixis Global Asset Management, I just want to thank everyone for calling in today. And I want to thank Drinker Biddle for the partnership. If you could, please mark your calendars. The next call will be January 23rd of 2018. Again, thanks for calling in. And with that, I'll turn it back to the operator to close out the call.
Thank you. And again, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. We thank you for your participation.